I see you navigated the detours. It's always an interesting annual trek. Because you gave me paper, I printed things out. No, not really. It's actually in my preparation for today's study, I found so many variations in different translations that I thought it might be helpful if we all had the same document. So we can all have the same thing together. We are going to attempt to do the entire chapter, which is lengthy. However, there's a lot of repetition in the text, which is why it's going to actually go a lot quicker than it might appear at first. Acts chapter 10. There are a number of scholars, theologians, pastors who point at this chapter as one of the most important stories in the New Testament, which I was surprised to hear them say that until you understand that what this represents is the unconditional opening of the gospel to the Gentiles by the major leader of the Jewish church at the time, Christian church of Peter. So, as is our typical approach here, I'm going to be reading the text and stopping and trying to bring out some details so that we can look at it a little more carefully than you might normally in your periodic reading. So we start here in Caesarea. Now, I have to stop right away to remind you all exactly where Caesarea is in relation to everything else. Okay, Jerusalem was here. If you remember last week, we had Peter going from Jerusalem to Lydda, where he healed the paralytic man, and then from Lydda went to Joppa, where he healed or raised Dorcas from the dead. And we have at the beginning of this passage, beginning chapter 9, we have Caesarea. Now, Caesarea, we've mentioned it and talked about it before, but we need to just make sure we understand exactly what we're talking about. Because there's another Caesarea right up here. There's Caesarea Philippi and Caesarea Maritime. And the maritime meaning the sea. So this is Caesarea by the sea. Caesarea was built by Herod the Great. When he was put in charge or given the green light by Augustus Caesar, Herod the Great was known as the Great Builder, and one of the towns that he was given to redo or to remodel was Joppa. But the people of Joppa hated Herod, and they rose up against him. They probably had a city council that wouldn't pass any of his permits. And there was the clash between Herod and Joppa, so he went, well, heck with you people. I'm going to go up the road. I'm going to build a town from scratch, which is what he did. And that became Caesarea Maritime. He named it, there was a town there before, a small one. I didn't write it down. Like Syracuse Tower or something was the name of it. He renamed it after Augustus Caesar. Dedicated it to him, and it was a shining pearl in the Mediterranean, is how it was described, because the harbor would have been state of the art. Now, ancient descriptions of Caesarea Maritime were so over the top that for centuries there were scholars who would say, you know, it's just all exaggeration, until they began doing archaeological digging and they started finding the various aspects of Caesarea that were extraordinary and actually matched the descriptions of the ancient writers. Caesarea became the, I'm not going to call it the capital, but you can call it the seat of Roman government in all of Palestine. This is where Pilate lived. Well, if you ever see, you're studying the New Testament and the story of Jesus and the crucifixion, you get the impression that Pilate lived in Jerusalem. Well, no, he was only there for the Passover and all the stuff that went along with that. He actually lived up here. He found an inscription on a stone in the ruins of Caesarea that has the name of Pilate on it. And it was like, again, the archaeological community went, oh, I guess the Bible is true. How many times do you have to be told that? Okay, so that's Caesarea. At Caesarea, there was a man, not a disciple, but a man named Cornelius, who is a centurion of what was known as the Italian cohort. And I just had to figure out, what does that mean? Any guesses? Don't just say they were Italian.
He was from Rome.
Was it like a special segment of the army?
Exactly. These were Roman-grown or Italian-grown soldiers. They were considered elite. It's a very bad comparison. It would be like calling them Navy SEALs. All right, these were the special ones. Most of the soldiers in the Roman army were conscripts. They would come into a region and they would say, okay, if you want to join up, we'll give you special privileges, but you're going to have to fight for Rome, some of that kind of thing. So there was some voluntary conscription. There was also the occasional involuntary conscription. But in a large battalion, not all of them are going to be Romans. As you were just the Roman army. But this Italian cohort, I found a variety of different comments. Apparently, this particular one had a specific name called the Italian cohort. They were known by that name, that designation. They were known throughout the empire that way, which I think is interesting. And apparently, this particular cohort was normally stationed in Austria. I couldn't find any other sources to, you know, verify that, but I thought, well, that's interesting. So why are they stationed here? Well, at that time, there was some unrest in the north. We had, if you remember last week, we were talking about Saul being up in Damascus and the Arabs being in charge of this half. So it makes you wonder if the Arabic tensions between Rome and Arabia were at a height. And so they brought this group in here. The Italian cohort is later mentioned in 69 AD as being around. Now, what happened in 69 and 70 AD? The Romans destroyed everything. And the Italian cohort was part of that. 10,000 Jews were killed in Damascus. 20,000 were killed in Caesarea. Now, so when did all of this happen in chapter 10? The guess is it's anywhere between 38 AD and 41 AD. So around 30 years before the big destruction of the countryside. So it says it's a cohort. Well, we've at various times we've talked about this, but
it's always good to recite it, because I doubt we can all remember it. We've all heard of the Roman Legion.
How many were in a legion? Many.
6,000. So 6,000 were in a legion. Now, in modern army terms, that would be a division. The legion was divided into 10 cohorts of 600 each. Or a battalion. Those 10 cohorts of 600 each were broken into 6 centuries. U-R-I-E-S. And in our terms, modern terms, it would be called a company. And then in modern terms, a company is then divided into squads. So you can have squads, company, battalion, division. That's kind of how it works. So you hear those terms when you read about World War II or some of the more recent conflicts. You get that idea. Well, this is how it was broken down. And because these were called centuries, yeah, there is an I in there somewhere. I'll dot it. They were obviously overseen by a centurion. And Cornelius was one. He was a centurion. One ancient historian described the qualifications of a centurion, saying, "Centurions are desired not to be overbold and reckless so much as good leaders of steady and prudent mind, not prone to take offensive to start fighting wantonly, but able, when overwhelmed and hard-pressed, to stand fast and to die at their posts." They were supposed to be very strong, strong leaders. Again, trying to figure out some of the various details and how all those happen. A lot of the elite or specially trained soldiers joined the army, joined the Roman Legion around 17 or 18 years old. That would be when their bodies were, you know, grown and strength was being developed. And their length of service was anywhere from 15 to 20 years. It sounds familiar, right? To those who are in the army, they can retire after 20 years. You know, the same thing would happen in this scenario. But a centurion was one who rose up through the ranks, and they commanded a great amount of respect and a great amount of power. Not only that they oversaw 100 people, 100 soldiers, but they were like miniature generals, because they would send out a century and their centurion to quell a rebellion in various spots. They would just say, "Cornelius, take your men and go to blank and fix it." They didn't have Twitter. They didn't have satellite phones. They could send a runner to get direction if something really unusual was happening, but when they're on the field, they made their own decisions. So there had to be a lot of power put in the hands of these kind of men. This is what I'm trying to get at, is there is a lot of respect for a man like this. A lot of respect. So not only is he an elite general, he's head of the Italian cohort. The church right now is about 5 or 6 years old. So the church is still spreading here and there in various forms and ways. And there's a description here in verse 2 of Cornelius himself. Now, he's not a Jew, he's a Roman. In fact, it's very clear in Acts chapter 11, verse 18. It says, they glorified God, saying, then to the Gentile God has granted repentance. So there's no question, this guy is not Jewish. But he is a devout man who feared God. With all of his household, gave alms generously to the people, and prayed continually to God. Not your typical description of a Roman centurion. Now, there are some who like to theorize that Cornelius was the one at the cross. No, very unlikely. There would be no reason for him to be moved from Jerusalem to Caesarea. He's probably been to Caesarea the whole time. But he's a devout man. He feared God, which is interesting if you remember the description of the church in chapter 9, verse 31. It said, the church throughout all Judea, Galilee, and Samaria had peace and was being built up and walking in the fear of the Lord. And the comfort of the Holy Spirit, it multiplied. So that concept of the fear of the Lord was there. But this is where the Bible translations start mixing things up. The ESV, which you have in front of you, says that he was a man who feared God. There are other translations that said he was a devout man who was a God-fearer, as if that's a title or a designation, which would be accurate. A God-fearer in this first century were Gentiles who worshipped as Jews but had never converted. So they hadn't taken circumcision, they didn't attend all the various ceremonies or anything like that. In other words, they were very religious people. They were God-fearers. Proselytes was another word that is used often in that case. Bottom line is, he's a man who's very sympathetic to the gospel. He's a very religious man. And someone with that kind of power, says he has a household and he's giving generously. Well, I dug around and found out that a centurion was paid 15 times the rate of a regular soldier. So if a regular soldier was making $20,000 a year, he was making $250,000 a year. All right? So he's a wealthy man. But he is generous with his wealth, and he has a household. Now it's interesting, another little trivia thing. It was very uncommon for a centurion to be married. Very uncommon. He might have concubines, but it was very uncommon for them to be married because it was difficult for them to take their whole families with them. That's not to say that Cornelius wasn't married, because there's a mention of the household and of relatives and other things of that nature. But there's a little bit of a controversy trying to figure out exactly what all that meant. So, he's generous with his money. He prays continually to God. So at verse 3, about the ninth hour, what time of the day is that? 3 p.m. Which is the normal day, time of the day for the second prayers of the Jewish people. They would pray at 9 a.m., 3 p.m. So it's a normal prayer time. At the ninth hour, he saw clearly. Fog machine, no kind of weird, shimmery special effects. It was bam, very clear in a vision of an angel of God who came in and spoke to him by name. I've said this before, and it's just kind of a wonderful thing. that the Bible is so, what's my word here? Not casual, but it's a, well, sure.
Matter of fact.
It's just, this is what happened. It's not this, oh, for goodness sake, you know, some big clickbait headline. Angel visits centurion. Click here for more. I mean, nothing like that. It's like, okay, he's praying and boom, there's an angel. I'm being a little facetious here, but we don't necessarily look for the supernatural in our lives. And so we might not see it. It might be right in front of us, but we are not open to seeing it. Yeah.
Why does it say that it's a vision? Why doesn't it just say the angel is there? Is there a difference between the angel actually being present and a vision of an angel?
That's a very good question. Because there's even discussions of the difference between a dream and a vision. Dream, technically, when you're asleep. Vision is a waking dream. But I'm not sure. That's a good question.
A vision is a vision. I mean, it's nothing anybody else could see. But whereas the angels appeared in other places, like in Abraham's time, Sarah saw him speaking to, you know, they can be seen by others if they're it's desired. But a vision is always a vision. The Bible's very clear.
Okay. I was just looking here just to make sure that we didn't have the conversion of Saul being declared as a vision. It just says it happens, but nobody else saw it. So you could say that was a vision.
Mm-hmm.
That Saul saw Christ. No one else,
they heard. But they saw the glory of a light.
They saw a light, but they didn't see
the
anything
glory,
else.
But in here, in a vision, and especially with the prophets, you have to be careful because the vision is really important, that it's separate from something that actually happens in our understanding of space and time. But it's something that is real and authentic. And it would just be, now I am going to combine the dream, even though I think they're separate. Because a vision is something that can happen when you're wide awake. Just like a dream, the authenticity of it when you waken, sometimes it's so real. And I think visions are that same, that it's real, but it's in another sphere beyond our understanding.
Does another dimension, sense? Almost,
yeah.
in that respect.
It's in our different consciousness, maybe. But it's authentic.
And that's a good question, because it applies to this entire chapter, because we have Peter having a vision as well, a waking vision. It was interesting, because there's the difference between the sleep dream, seeing something in a dream, and the wake, seeing something in a vision, because one guy titled his sermon on chapter 10 as, I have a dream. Mm-hmm. I thought, no, that's not exactly right. And I know what you're trying to say, but that isn't what it was about. Anyway, so an angel appears to him, calls him by name, and Cornelius stared at him in terror. This doesn't mean he was hiding under the bed. And remember who he was. This was a man who stood in battle. And if you remember the ancient historian description, the character of a centurion was one that when it got hard, he would stand and fight until he died. So this was not a man of fear. Nothing. You can almost picture the grizzled, you know, scarred He-Man of that era. And he's praying. He's a devout man. He believes in God. No question. He fears God. And then suddenly an angel appears and he begins to quake. Now, it says here, one guy put it in this way. He said, he was alarmed but not afraid. So I thought that was interesting to make that distinction. And ultimately, the angel had his attention. He got his attention. And Cornelius asks, so what is it, Lord? Now, there are those who said, oh, he called him Lord. That must mean this was Jesus. No, he was just being polite. This was an honorific. This was saying, what is it, Lord? You know, there's some powerful being in front of him. And the angel said, your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God. Now, send men to Joppa. Okay? That's one reason why I set this up. So we see this, by the way, this is around 30 to 35 miles. A day's walk, approximately. Send men to Joppa and bring one, Simon, who is called Peter. He's lodging with Simon a tanner, whose house is by the sea, at 1019 West Palo Verde Drive. There's no address. There's no GPS. They've just got to walk into a town and go, anybody know where Simon the Tanner lives? Well, of course they do. Yeah, he's a well-known guy in that area. But, you know, there wasn't a zip code. So back then, you were told to go and find somebody by the centurion. Yeah, you're going to do it. When the angel who had spoke to him had departed, Cornelius called two of his servants and a, what kind of soldier? Devout soldier. Isn't that interesting? Same word as found in verse 2, describing Cornelius. A devout man, a devout soldier. Is it suggesting that the soldier was also a God-fearer? Maybe. Or it could mean he was just devoted to Cornelius. You can read it either way, but he's a devout soldier. From among those who attended him, and having related everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. Now, I have a question for you. Why didn't the angel just say, Cornelius, go find Peter? Why send people to go bring Peter to you? Why did the angel not just tell him to go himself? I don't have an answer. I'm curious what you would think. Because we know the rest of the story here.
When Peter comes back, he talks to his whole household. Mm-hmm. If it was just Cornelius, then it would just be Cornelius there.
That's a good point. There's also a point that John Stott brought out in his commentary on this entire passage. He said, chapter 10 is not as much about the conversion of Cornelius as it is of the conversion of Peter to a new way of thinking. So asking Peter to make the trek, and we'll see in a moment, the importance of that would not have been as significant as Cornelius going and asking for an audience. But having God in his divine sovereignty, and we'll see here what else is going on at the same time, there's something else happening. But it was a very interesting question just popped up when I was reading this, going, wait, why is he telling other people to go? Because in other places, you know, God tells Philip to go, and he goes. He didn't say send one of your people. It was to him. So the vision continues, or the story.
Another thing that's interesting when you, going back to talking about sending the one devout soldier, he told them everything. Hmm. It had to be very, very devout. There was some sort of like-mindedness or something, because otherwise it would be, I'm not saying anything, but I think he's gone off as a robber. I mean, he's
that's a good point.
Told them everything. He told them
that's
he
true.
Gave him a vision to go find. So that would be really unusual. So the love that these people have for this man is evident.
That's a very
I
good
think
point.
It's beyond just servant. He specifically picked these couple servants and this one out of 100 soldiers.
Very he also good. Sends a soldier to make sure that the servants don't run away.
Yeah, but and that one. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, I mean, seriously, you could have, if depending on the relationship of these servants to their Cornelius, they could just keep going and end up in Egypt for all they do. But no, it's It was a group of three, yeah.
And as a commander, could he really leave his post and leave his men? Leave somebody else in charge, you know?
Yeah, again, it depends on whether he had enough vacation days built up.
PTO.
If you go back to the centurion and Jesus, and he says, Lord, I do not presume to come to you, but I say to my, you know, I'm a man under authority, there are the people under authority to me. It sounded like he could leave, but that is a good point, but...
Yeah, I mean, who knows what the circumstances were? The bottom line is God knew, and God set it up this way, and the angel comes and gives him this very specific and clear direction, and he follows through. So verse 9, the next day, so remember our time frame, the previous day was 3 o'clock. So, if at 3:05 the two servants and the centurion started walking, they might get to Joppa by 11 o'clock that night. But you know, they didn't leave at 3:05. They, you know, probably had to gather some stuff. You know, he had to call them. He had to explain to them all the details of what's going on. So maybe they didn't leave until dinner time. Well, even then, that may be they're traveling all night to get there. So more than likely, they set out the next morning, very early, before the crack of dawn. So we have the next day. As they were on their journey and approaching the city, Peter went up on the housetop of Simon the Tanner, where he was staying, about the sixth hour to pray. So what time is that? Noon. Noon is not necessarily a normal prayer time. But there are examples where you have someone who is either in great distress or who is extremely devout, who's praying every third hour. So third hour, sixth hour, ninth hour, and then at the mealtime. So there possibly he's praying more frequently. Now the houses are set up back in these days. They didn't have necessarily pitched roofs. Flat roofs. We see a lot of that adobe type architecture here, where it's just a flat roof. Sometimes it was a meeting place, sometimes it was a place where they would dry food. They would, depending on the size of the house and its setup. And we also have some hints that this particular house was a very nice one. We'll look at that in a second. But Simon the Tanner's house is by the sea. So maybe Peter went up to the rooftop because he can see the sea. It's a quiet place. He can be praying. And then his stomach grumbled, verse 10. And he was hungry. It's lunchtime. And he wanted something to eat. That is so wonderfully normal. You don't find this kind of language in many places. But right here, he's up there and, I'm thinking a good burger. What do you think? You know. But while they were preparing it downstairs, he fell into a trance. Now, this is not the same word as vision. The word vision is horama, and that is the word vision used throughout the New Testament. There's one time in, I think it's Matthew, we have a vision, and all the other uses of that word horama are found in Acts. This word, let's see, is the word ecstasis. That's why you see it translated as trance. Stasis. Kind of that, I don't know, that frozen, immovable situation, if someone is in stasis, they are, well, they're not doing anything, they're just there. So this is different than the vision. It's actually much more powerful. The things that are happening are more dramatic. One fellow said the idea of an ecstasis is that whatever is happening to that individual is very visual, extremely visual. And they are the only ones to see it, kind of like the vision, but it's very much inside because they're not doing anything else. They're in just kind of this immobile stance. And if you were to walk up to someone who is in ecstasis, you would wonder, are they asleep? Are they dead? Is something wrong with them? Because they're just kind of frozen. He fell into a trance. And one of the fascinating pictures, he saw the heavens open and something like a great sheet descending. Now, that word for great sheet is the same word for sail on a boat. Where is he standing? He's on the top of a roof and he can see the sea. The idea of sails are there in his vision. So it kind of, you see what's happening here. You have this picture of this great sheet. So it's not a bed sheet. Even if it's king sized, we're talking the size of a sailboat sheet. So it'd fill half this room. Well, this is not some tiny little thing, oh, let's lay down on the sheet that just came. No, this is something large. Held down by its four corners on the earth. So it's not flapping around, it's this almost a held. You think of the big flags at the opening ceremonies in football games. Just think of something, maybe not that large, but you get the idea. It's held down on the four corners, so it's flat.
It doesn't say held down, it's let down.
Okay, let down. Same idea is that it's flat. Okay? But on it are all kind of animals and reptiles and birds of the air. Now, that's got to be a pretty big sheet to have a lot of animals on it. So. And there came a voice to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And Peter says, "Medamos," which is a Greek word, which is translated here as "by no means." It's also used in other places, translated as "absolutely not, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean." Now, common, this is where the translations get all wonky. The NASB translates it as unholy. Other translations have it as impure, but the actual word means common, profane. The things that are just, they're everywhere, but they are not necessarily holy. And you go, wait a minute, what in the world are they talking about? Which is why in your handout, look at page 4. I found this for you. Is a chart of clean and unclean animals based on Leviticus chapter 11. Whoever put this together had a lot of fun, I would say. In particular, I actually started laughing when I was reading some of the details. Look on the very first section of clean flying animals and unclean flying animals. Look at the unclean list. Flying animals, flamingos. I don't think flamingos fly very much. What do you think? And then what about penguins? Penguins? Sorry. They can fly if you throw them in the air, but they will come down very quickly with a plop. And also, this isn't part of some biblical list. I went and looked in Leviticus. I couldn't find penguins. They hadn't found them yet. They didn't know they existed. So I was having a little bit of fun with, you know, mocking this particular thing. But it is very interesting when you look at the various kinds of animals, because the biblical text says there are all kinds of animals, reptiles, birds of the air. So you have clean animals, unclean animals, those that are fit to eat, those that are not. And he didn't mention insects, but there is such a thing as clean insects and unclean insects. You could eat locusts, but you couldn't eat other things. So I guess if you want to eat the chocolate-covered locust down at the fair, go right ahead, you're kosher. Then there's land animals and water animals and all that. It's just fascinating to see the separation. But Peter is very concerned here because he's a holy man. He is a devout Jew. He follows the Jewish law. It wasn't when he became a believer in Christ, he then jettisoned all of his upbringing and his separation from the world. The idea of kosher or clean or unclean foods has been a point of mockery ever since the Old Testament times. Those who were not Jewish would say, well, just eat it. There's nothing wrong with it. What's wrong with you? And I came across a number of anecdotes in the various sermons or commentaries I would read, that I was reading, one guy talking about going to India, and he was warned, said, never refuse the food. No matter what they put in front of you, eat it. Because that might have cost that family a week's wages. So you don't complain about it, just eat it. You might have to go to the hospital when you get home, but just eat it. And this one guy said, yeah, I came home and I was in the hospital for 3 days. And I retasted the curry for weeks. But I ate it because that was supposed to. It wasn't an issue of clean or unclean. I had no idea what I was eating, but I wanted to honor my hosts. Well, that isn't necessarily what's being talked about here, because why in the world would God set up this separation of clean and unclean animals in Leviticus? What's the point?
Protection for the people so that they wouldn't get,
That's one theory, but what's wrong with bacon?
If it's not cured, it's
cured. No, but, if it's cured and salted and all that, it's clean enough. You see, that's a theory.
They're omnivorous. They eat all kinds.
Yeah.
Garbage.
So do goats.
No, it's not like pigs.
Goats will eat cans, they'll eat really, we can get into that debate. Mm-hmm. So there is an element of truth to that, but the point is a spiritual one, not a physical one. The point was separation. The Jews were to be separate from everyone else. And this was one mark of their separation. If you were a devout Jew, you would follow these sets of obligations, these sets of rules, and here's, it was set up very early, and they followed it forever. Even today, the most orthodox of the Orthodox Jews have very strong restrictions. I don't remember the letter designation, but there's a letter on the food boxes.
Okay.
Is it a K for kosher?
Sure.
And so, if you have a Orthodox Jewish friend who's coming over, you can go to the grocery store and buy the foods and know for sure that this soup block is kosher, that it wasn't made from the wrong kind of animal fat. And that's how specific it gets. So why is it such a big deal for Peter? And why would God be coming to him and saying, go ahead. There's a pig out there in that blanket. Go eat it. And he's going, absolutely not. I will not do that. What's the big deal? What's happening here? Why is God doing this to Peter?
Because what you just said, because it was spiritual, to show that the Gentiles are can be grafted into the Jewish animals, mm-hmm. that they are part of that tree, that nothing can separate you from the love right. of God, neither principality nor Jew nor Greek nor mm-hmm. Gentile, all that. But that is the beginning of the circumcision. It's a circumcision of the heart. The food, the dietary, is a matter of the heart. But the people are all one. We have one Lord, one faith, one baptism.
That's right.
Through Jesus Christ.
I mean, we find in the next chapter, chapter 11, Peter, after this whole thing, he goes to Jerusalem, and it says in verse 2 of chapter 11, the circumcision party criticized him for eating with a Gentile. The circumcision party. That means those who say, only those who are committed Jewish followers. A Gentile could be a God-fearer, but they could not be Jewish until they were circumcised, until they actually entered the fold. Now, Mark 7:18, you have Jesus talking about this. Different circumstances, of course. But Mark 7:18, after he told a parable, he said to them, "Then you're also without understanding. Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him? Since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and then is expelled. And thus he declared all foods clean." This was Jesus. And here we are, these years later, and Peter's going, no. So that one teaching still hadn't quite sunk in. I'll just continue the passage here. "And the voice came to him again, a second time, 'What God has made clean, do not call impure.'" This happened three times. How many times did Peter reject Jesus? Three times. And here he's doing it again. This trance, this vision from God came to him three times. And three times Peter, or two times Peter said, no. And then, third time, okay, I think I get the point. Maybe, or no, I don't get the point. Because it says in verse 17, "Now while Peter was inwardly perplexed as to the vision that he had seen might mean," notice the word "while." So Peter's up on the roof. He's in this trance. He has this big sheet of animals, and God's telling him that everybody is welcome. Anything is that I have made is pure. It's okay. I'm changing the rules. It's a new covenant. While that's happening, it says, "Behold, the men who were sent by Cornelius, having made an inquiry for Simon's house, stood at the gate." Which meant they had been traveling probably all morning to arrive at noon. 7 hours meant they left probably 5 a.m. if they went by foot. If they were on horseback, it cut it in half. But they get there at the same moment that Peter has just come out of this trance vision and wondering, what in the world was that about? He's still not clear. He's accepting, but he's still not quite clear. And it says that they're standing at the gate, which means this house was big enough to have a gate. It wasn't just a little row house down in the slums. This is a nice place. And more than likely, it was an outside stairway. They would access the roof from an outside stair rather than using up the real estate inside the homes for inside stairways. That actually came later. So he's out there. He hears, there's people at the gate. Someone says, they're here to talk to you. So he comes down and they called out. They didn't enter the gate. They stood at the gate and called out to ask whether Simon, who was called Peter, was lodging there. And so while Peter was pondering the vision, the Spirit said to him, "Behold, three men are looking for you. Rise, go down, and accompany them without hesitation." That's an important phrase. Don't even think about it. Without hesitation, accept them into the house and talk to them. "For I have sent them." And Peter went down to the men and said, "I am the droid you're looking for."
No,
I knew you knew I was going to say that. Because we just watched the first Star Wars the other night. "I'm the one you're looking for. What's the reason you're coming?" And they said, "Well, Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and God-fearing man, who is well spoken of in the Jewish nation, was directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and to hear what you have to say." So he invited them in to be his guests. Pause. He invited them in. It's like, so what's the big deal? They were there at the house. This is, you know, he's supposed to be nice. No. These are Gentiles. You don't invite Gentiles into your house. You just don't. Peter's going to have a bit of preparation before he's going to be able to stick this key and turn it, according to John MacArthur. A strict Jew wouldn't have anything to do with a Gentile. In fact, a strict Jew wouldn't even be the guest in a Gentile house, nor would he have a guest in his house, since Gentiles were unclean. The scribal law said the dwelling place of Gentiles are unclean. And here's an interesting footnote to get a thought that this is perhaps very specific. It was considered that the dust or the dirt from a Gentile country was defiled. And if anybody happened to have some Gentile country dirt on their feet and tracked it into Israel, the dirt remained defiled. It never mingled with the Israel soil. It just stayed there, continuously defiling the land. Consequently, whenever they left a Gentile country, they would always do what became a famous phrase in the Bible. They would shake the dust off their feet, so as not to track any Gentile pollution back into Israel. In Matthew 10:14, remember when Jesus sent out the 70, he said, "Go two by two, and if anybody does not hear your gospel, shake off the dust from your feet." In other words, treat them as though they were Gentile and unclean. Go ahead.
He's staying at the Tanner's house, though.
Hmm?
The Tanner's house, Simon the Tanner. Isn't he unclean?
He is. Which was significant that Peter would stay with, but Simon's a Jew.
So it's like he thinks he's being all free-minded. But
and he is. He's being very different than his Jerusalem friends. So there's, and you have to also remember, Peter went to Samaria and was part of the revival there, but Samaritans were half Jews. Cornelius was no Jew at all. There was not a drop of Jewish blood in him. He was full bore Italian Roman. So he's the true picture of the Gentile. Think of how the temple is set up. On the outer edge is what? The court of the Gentiles. The next stage is the court of women. Then the court of the Israelites, where the men could go. And then it was the court of the priests, then the holy place, and then the holy of holies. So even their own temple was a picture of how far out the edges the Gentiles were pushed. This idea of separation of Jew and Gentile, where you also had the Greeks hated the barbarians. Those who could not speak Greek properly. That's why that's where the name barbar came from, because it sounded like they were going bar, 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 bar. Think of how a German would sound to a Greek. There's this guttural garbage coming out of their mouth. They can't speak right. Aristotle, he actually wrote this in his book Politics. How can men who only bark ever rule the world? He believed that the world's climate maintained the difference between the Greek and the barbarian. He explained that those who lived in the cold lands of the north had plenty of courage and spirit, but little skill and intelligence. But those who lived in the warm south had plenty of skill and intelligence and culture, but very little spirit and courage. So only the Greeks lived in a climate designed by nature to produce the perfectly blended character. That's Aristotle. Edersheim, in his book The Life of Christ, Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, milk drawn by a Gentile, if a Jew had not been present to watch it, or bread and oil prepared by a Gentile, was unlawful. Their wine was wholly interdicted. A mere touch of a Gentile polluted the entire cask. Nay, even to put one's nose to a Gentile wine was strictly prohibited. This is a big deal of what's happening in this picture. And I have run out of time. Believe it or not. Wow. I can't finish this in 2 minutes. Other than to say he invited them as guests, and we'll pick up at this point next week. Haha, then I don't have to study as much. Yay! Let's pray. Bless our time. Lord, your word is so full. There's so many details, so many intricate aspects that draw and paint this marvelous picture of what's going on here. And while we have a understanding here, these 2,000 years later, of what was going on, it's trying to put ourselves in the mind of Peter and of the people, of how revolutionary your gospel was and still is, in that matter. So as we think about that, as we move into our time of worship, that we praise your holy name that you provided for us Gentiles, for our salvation. In Jesus' name, amen.